The last lecture. Mineral physics. We debated about what to talk about in the last lecture, and so part of this content comes from feedback from you guys. And initially, I think we had decided on sort of an overview, sort of state of knowledge and so on. But as Abby and I were discussing it, it became more and more clear that we actually didn't know anything, so there was no state of knowledge to talk about. So instead of state of knowledge, more in the form of questions. Actually, I will start out with the sort of state of progress in solving the equilibrium problem, which you explored in the first tutorial, and some of the implications for understanding seismic structure of the transition zone. And then I'll go on to our state of ignorance rather than our state of knowledge. And what a lot of it will be focused around are a part of the Earth that came up in a lot of discussions, in a lot of different forms, in a lot of lectures, and that is the importance of boundaries in the Earth. Lots of different kinds of boundaries, lots of different sort of significance for dynamics and geochemistry and mineral physics and seismology of these different boundaries. And there are a lot of these, and I'll talk about just a few, and we'll see how far I get. The transition zone, the coromantle boundary, the boundary between, one that we usually don't think about in the deep Earth, but one that could be very interesting, the boundary between the surficial hydrosphere, that is the oceans, and the solid Earth beneath, and the asthenosphere. And these boundaries may be defined in different ways, by phase, by contrast in composition, by contrast in rheology, and they may or may not be complete or partial barriers to the transport of mass or heat or momentum. Okay, so let's start with the transition zone, and this is something you looked at in the first tutorial, and what you saw there was that the variations of velocity in the transition zone are due to variations in the phase assemblage. Okay, so a whole host of phase transitions going on between, say, 400 kilometers depth and 800 kilometers depth. Pressure, of course, plays a role, although the phase transitions are actually more important than the effect of pressure, if you just consider the sort of radial profile, at least in the transition zone. Temperature has an influence, as this graph shows, as does bulk composition. The transition zone is also interesting because it has two, perhaps three, discontinuities in it. And these are neat because they are potentially very informative. These are places that seismologists can study in great detail, and there is the potential for getting a lot of information from the detailed structure and shape of the 410, the 660, and the 520 as to the mineralogy of this region, the composition of this region, and so on. Okay, so what I'll do is sort of go through the equilibrium problem more fully than I have in the past, what's behind those calculations you did in the first tutorial, and then look at a particular issue, which is how the velocity depends on temperature. And I want you to notice one thing right now is that the velocity depends on temperature as you go from red to blue in sort of a systematic way here, really simple, and then you get here and boom, the velocity depends very strongly on temperature. It becomes exquisitely sensitive to temperature in the vicinity of these phase transitions, and I'll come back to that in a second. Okay, so the equilibrium problem is this. Given a bulk composition, a pressure, and a temperature, put all those atoms together, apply pressure and temperature to them, and the interesting, remarkable, difficult to deal with thing about the mantle is that those elements will organize themselves into several discrete phases, all of which have very different physical properties. So you first have to figure out what the phase equilibria are, and then figure out the physical properties of those individual phases with their equilibrium compositions, and then put it all together to get the seismic wave velocities, density, heat capacity, thermal expansivity, whatever you want, of the rock. Okay, so this is the way that that Caroline and I have set up the equilibrium problem. You start with a fundamental relation, as always. In this case, Gibbs free energy versus pressure, temperature, and composition. And that depends on the Gibbs free energy of the individual phases, or species, and members. and also on a term that depends on the entropy of mixing. You can think of it that way, or the Gibbs free energy of mixing. And then with a Legendre transformation, we describe the Gibbs free energy versus pressure and temperature of the individual species, actually as the Helmholtz free energy, and that gets written like this. And you've seen all of this before in different forms. This is the Birch-Murnaghan Eulerian finite strain expansion for the Helmholtz free energy versus finite strain. Little f is the finite strain here. And this is the sum over vibrational modes that we talked about in the lattice dynamics lecture. It looks kind of different, and what I've done is, instead of express it as a sum over vibrational modes, I've expressed it as an integral over some vibrational density of states. Okay, how many modes per sort of unit frequency interval. And that conversion from sum to integral introduces a bunch of other stuff, and that's what all this stuff is. The important thing is that theta here is basically the mean vibrational frequency of the material, and that depends on volume through the Grüneisen parameter and through the volume derivative of the Grüneisen parameter. Okay, so now you know everything about your rock. It's all contained in that box, everything you would ever want to know, and all the equilibrium thermodynamic properties then fall out by taking strain and temperature derivatives. So somebody asked before about the expression for the elastic constants. Here it is, and it looks messy, but basically you've got a piece that depends on the Eulerian finite strain here. That basically gives you the volume dependence. How do the elastic constants depend on compression? And then we have a bit that depends on temperature through the thermal or vibrational energy here. And this gets multiplied by the Grüneisen parameter. You end up having to generalize the Grüneisen parameter to a tensorial form. And this is the strain derivative of that Grüneisen tensor, which we end up assuming is isotropic.
Do you calculate phase transformation?
Yes, absolutely.
And how well do they match with experimental?
Very well. Yeah, within experimental uncertainty. And yeah, whatever that is. I mean, obviously we have to deal. I mean, the experimental uncertainty is non-trivial, and the idea is to get some best fitting match to all the available data, weighted by sort of your confidence in that data.
When you go back to that picture of the transition zone and how you're explicitly sensitive to temperature at those phase transformation points, I'm going to make the point again that one of the recent embarrassments of mineral physics is that we always thought we had the pressure nailed from phase transformations to the phase transformations the olivine and darn systematics of the transition zone. And really, within the last 5 to 10 years, we've had the opportunity to look in situ at these phase transformations as you're doing an experiment at high pressures and temperatures. And the first order result that's come out is that we can't resolve the pressure of those phase transformations to within 2 PPa.
Right, right.
So, and that's a big...
Right, and that's a challenge that I fully trust the experimentalists will solve very soon. But as far as this exquisite sensitivity does, what that uncertainty and pressure will do is shift all three of these curves by about the same amount either way. And so the sensitivity will remain. This sensitivity just depends on the Clapeyron slope, and nobody disagrees about whether the Clapeyron slope is positive or negative, and that it's non-zero. So that sensitivity is going to remain. And again, most of it will be a shift of all three curves by roughly the same amount back and forth, but details, like if you look at this blue one here, whether Akimoto-ite is stable along this particular adiabat, that's open to debate. Whether, you know, the slope of this high gradient line here, that's open to debate. So sure, yeah, some of the details will change.
Impossible to match with any composition and any reasonable view. The gradients are so different. they basically cross the gradients in the seismological model. And you won't do it just like by having layers, a stratification, a radial stratification of composition. It has to be something strange, you know, some compositional gradient or something. So that's something really interesting that, you know, it's out there. It hasn't been out there.
No. Oh, no, no, no. It does. Absolutely does. Yeah. These are adiabats, so I don't have the upper thermal boundary layer in here. If you put the upper thermal boundary layer in, you get a beautiful low velocity zone. Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think one of the messages to take from this is that there is a lot of potential for very rich interaction between mineral physics and seismology in comparing, you know, what does a particular compositional model of the mantle look like to a seismologist. And this is not something that mineral physicists have done to the extent that they could have over the past 10, 20, 30 years. And our idea was that there was a sufficient amount of experimental data now to at least attempt an interim synthesis, realizing that there are lots of uncertainties remaining in phase equilibria, elastic properties, and so on, but put together our best guess at what the mantle looks like now and compare it as directly as possible to seismological data, with the hope that this would advance both fields. Yes? Yeah, there's all kinds of interesting stuff going on in here, and this is another area where the phase equilibrium might have to be revisited. One of the things that happens in here is that at high temperatures, ringwoodite breaks down to garnet and magnesioworstite. That's something that came out of our calculations that hadn't really been anticipated before. It hasn't been totally unobserved before. There are a couple of points here and there, but people never really thought about it as being important for the transition zone. So instead of the standard paradigm is ringwoodite goes to perovskite plus magnesioworstite at the 660, right? Well, this is different. This is ringwoodite going to garnet plus magnesioworstite much earlier than that. And that's what gives you the lower velocities here compared to here, because it's a transition that's encouraged by high temperature. Which is a number approaching infinity, right? right. Now, I think there's a lot of room for really cool stuff to do here. Okay. So anyway, I mean, there's nothing magic here. I mean, this relation is great. It's a compact way of expressing the complete information, all you need to know about the rock, but of course it depends on parameters, and those parameters have to be constrained by something external to thermodynamics. I've said many times that thermodynamics by itself doesn't give you quantitative predictions. You have to supplement it with experimental measurements or first principles calculations or whatever, and so it depends on measurements like this, constraining what the form of that fundamental relation looks like, the parameters of it. And so this is just one example of many I could have shown. This is a particularly cool measurement, I think. It harkens back to our lattice dynamics lecture, where we looked at the acoustic vibrational modes. They have zero frequency at zone center, and then they increase linearly. And so if you can measure the frequency of those modes very close to zone center, you just divide the frequency by the wave vector, you get the slope, and that gives you the acoustic velocity. And so that's exactly what Brillouin spectroscopy does. It measures the frequencies of these acoustic modes at the wavelength of visible light, which is enormous compared to lattice spacing, and so you're very close to zone center in this sort of linear regime. And so they measure Vp and Vs as a function of propagation direction in the crystal. Each of these lines then corresponds to one of the three acoustic branches. And this is at two different temperatures. And the dependence of velocity on direction here in the measurement is a direct measure of the anisotropy of the crystal. And the two different shear waves, of course, have different velocities, and so that's related to shear wave splitting, which Guy talked about, and so on. So these are very important measurements. And there are many different ways of getting at the elastic constants, and the interesting thing is that the experimental ones span a very wide range of frequency scale, and as far as we can tell, the elastic constants don't depend on frequency over the experimental range. Barely at all. Probably even if we went down to kilohertz, they wouldn't depend. This one, by static compression, you can only get the bulk modulus. And for the bulk modulus, it, again, doesn't appear to depend on frequency at all the way from 0 to gigahertz, or terahertz even. The shear modulus we've measured over this more restricted range of megahertz to terahertz. Seismology tells us that the shear modulus will become frequency dependent as we go to lower frequencies still, and that is one of the big challenges that I might have time to return to later. Okay, so this is an example of how you constrain one of these parameters. So this is the shear modulus versus temperature here, the measurements from Orson Anderson's lab here in the circles. And this is what happens if you change the shear part of that eta tensor by plus or minus 1. And so what this is meant to show is that the constraints on this eta s parameter provided by the data are actually pretty good. You can constrain it to like plus or minus probably 0.1 just based on this comparison. Okay. And that's for forsterite. And we do have data like this now on at least the most abundant species of most of the important mantle minerals. And I don't expect you to get anything out of this, just that it is possible to make compilations like this. These are all the parameters you need to specify the fundamental relation of the species, and it's these parameters that are sort of behind, underneath, if you like, the calculations you did in the first tutorial. And this is actually just a subset. That's most important for the upper mantle and shallow transition zone.
Mars?
Yes.
I mean, it could be my training as a mineral physicist, but when I look at those numbers, I like to blur my eyes a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Try to imagine, you know, the real error bar.
Sure.
Of those numbers. And I was just wondering if you've systematically gone through and propagated all of the uncertainties into your models, see how your story smears out.
Yes. Yes, we have done that. And in a more recent compilation, which I couldn't get LaTeX quite to make, we do have estimates of the errors on all these guys, and you can propagate that into the errors on the rock properties and so on. In the velocity, it ends up being, in the shear wave velocity, it ends up being plus or minus 1% or so for the rock, something like that.
This compilation,
yes, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, so this is just... Well, a year ago, yeah. Takes a while at JGR. But anyway, and of course, you know, the thermodynamic theory is great, but it depends on all these measurements here and more, right? That all goes in, of course. Okay, so once you have that compilation, then you can start asking questions about what transition zone structure would look like in a mineralogical earth model, okay? So we can predict what seismic wave velocities will look like versus pressure, temperature, composition in the earth. And what we focused on initially is sort of the upper mantle and transition zone because that's where the experimental data is best. And you get some interesting things. So what we're asking here, what we're after here is getting at the lateral heterogeneity in velocity in the mantle, right? You saw all those beautiful tomographic slices from Guy and from Barbara and from Adam. What controls the scale of those lateral variations? And can we convert those lateral variations in velocity to lateral variations in temperature or composition or whatever? And I think the answer is that we can begin to do that, yes. And in the transit, the transition zone is a particularly interesting area, and guys, that it's a particularly difficult one, at least for tomography, and so this is just sort of extra motivation to try to get at better models of transition zone structure than from the seismological point of view. And okay, so what we're going to focus on is just the effect of temperature. So if you vary temperature laterally, how much does the velocity change? And one way to express that is in terms of a derivative, okay, derivative of velocity versus temperature, right? So that's what we have on the left-hand axis here, on the vertical axis. And here we have pressure, or depth, whatever. And you see that the temperature derivative of the shear of the velocity, all right, that is a sort of scaling, if you like, between the tomographic slice and a temperature field, this is what's being plotted here versus depth, it's not particularly smooth. The red is what you get out of a multiphase mantle. The blue is what you get if you ignore the effect of phase transformations. And so I showed you in that initial slide where we had the three velocity curves, I showed you how in the vicinity of phase transformations, the velocity becomes extremely sensitive to temperature. Plus, if this peak is here, all right, that's the expression of that sensitivity that we saw in that first slide. That's the Olivine-Weisley transition. All the other transitions also have peaks. And you can actually have negative values of this derivative. You can have positive values. It jumps around quite a bit. And so this is going to be an interesting challenge to get at lateral variations of temperature in the transition zone. And I think you can sort of turn it around, given that the phase transitions have a large effect on this, maybe by some combination of seismology and mineral physics, we can get at better constraints on what the mineralogy of the transition zone is. Yes? Yes, this calculation assumes that the seismic wave does not produce a phase transformation. The idea is that if you compare one region of the Earth to another, and they're both at different temperatures, the phase equilibria here are going to be different from the phase equilibria here, right? The seismic wave going through here and going through here don't cause any phase transformations, but the phase assemblage is different in the cold and the hot region. And that's what's being expressed here by the spikes. Okay, so, and you can show that the magnitude of these spikes is related to the difference in velocity between the two transforming phases, the Clapeyron slope, and the range of pressure over which the transition occurs. And, okay, I won't spend any time on this. This is just to show that you can compute velocity versus temperature at a given depth, right? And you can take the velocity from the tomographic model, use this relationship, figure out what the temperature is at that point. I think we have a little ways to go in terms of being able to do this securely, confidently, but our idea was to get a start on it and focus mineral physicists on you know, what properties need to be measured better and so on. Okay. So there are uncertainties in those calculations I showed you. They come from experimental uncertainties, from the difficulty of doing the experiments and so on, different techniques, whatever. One of the interesting things about mineral physics, and this has been true for a while, is that one of the biggest uncertainties are more fundamental than that. And that is that there might be new phases that we haven't found yet. There might be new physics that we haven't considered yet, and there might be new chemistry. And I wanted to give you an example of each of those. A new phase that we hadn't dreamed of before, some new physics that actually had been dreamed of before but had never been seen experimentally until very recently, and some new chemistry that also hadn't been dreamed of before. Okay, so new phases. Phase transitions are important because, as we just saw in the transition zone, velocity contrasts associated with them are large compared with other sources of lateral heterogeneity, the effect of temperature, even the effect of pressure. And these phase transformations, as we've talked about in several different lectures, can influence the dynamics through exchange of latent heat and through the volume of transformation. Yeah. And so one way to ask the question is, are the reactions that form magnesium silicate perovskite at 660 kilometers, are those the last? All right. There is a lot there. Well, there's some experimental data that suggests that there are no phase transformations, at least in the most abundant minerals, over large fractions of the lower mantle. All right. And so people felt relatively comfortable with magnesium silicate perovskite being the most abundant mineral in the lower mantle all the way through. But then this was always in the back of our minds too, seismological observations like this. And what this is a representation of the of a discontinuity that sits above the core mantle boundary by 100, 200 kilometers, depending on where you look. It's thought of as the top of the D double prime layer at the base of the mantle. And this discontinuity is seen in some places and not in others. And I imagine different seismologists would draw different maps. But what these bars represent then are the thickness of the D double prime layer as measured by the height of this discontinuity above the core mantle boundary. Right? So this question has always been in the back of our minds, what might be causing this seismic structure? Okay, so just this year, Japanese group, Murakami et al., synthesized a new phase, the post-perovskite phase. And we've already discussed this in various forums during this meeting already. The starting material was MgSO3, so same composition as perovskite. They added some platinum for pressure calibration, actually. They used a laser-heated diamond anvil cell, and they measured the temperature by measuring the black body radiation of the sample. This is a fairly standard technique in the laser-heated diamond cell. Things at 2000 K glow pretty brightly, and the color and intensity of that glow are related to the temperature. And the probe was X-ray diffraction, and a couple of people have asked me why hadn't people seen this transformation before? And there are a lot of ways of answering that question, but one answer would be the advent of synchrotron sources. Synchrotron sources are very powerful X-ray sources that allow you to probe the structure of very small samples, which we always have to deal with at high pressure, very small samples, very precisely. And so here's the X-ray diffraction pattern of perovskite, and it used to be a great feat to sort of resolve this triplet here between these three diffraction lines of perovskite. And here in this experiment, even at 100, over 100 GPa, you see that they're very well resolved. So this is partly due to the power of the synchrotron source. Okay, anyway. So here is the perovskite structure. You can understand what each of these little peaks are. Each of these peaks corresponds to an interatomic spacing, or actually a spacing between planes of atoms. And you can match up each of these with the perovskite structure. They go to somewhat higher pressures, 121 GPa, and they see new peaks. This one has no counterpart up here, for example. This one has no counterpart. This triplet here, and so on. This one has no counterpart here, and so on. So, they were done at temperature. They took X-ray diffraction patterns both at temperature and after temperature quench. And I don't know why they chose to show a temperature quench one, possibly because the signal to noise is better after you quench. Anyway, so there's no way to match this set of peaks with the perovskite structure. It has to be a new phase. Nobody would disagree with that. And the only question is what the structure of this guy is. And they showed that they were able to explain almost all the peaks with a phase that goes by the name of CMCM after the space group. Okay, and I'll show you what that structure looks like in a minute. You can argue about what the temperature really was. You can argue about what the pressure really was, but you cannot argue with the fact that they have formed a new phase. There's no doubt about that. The pressure uncertainties depend mostly on uncertainties in the platinum equation of state, and they could be 5 GPa, as large as 5 GPa. Temperature uncertainties could be, yeah, okay, several hundred degrees. maybe even 1,000 degrees?
I mean, yeah. It's not just measuring temperature, but you're already at 50% of the temperature. It's also knowing that your X-ray beam is exactly centered where your hot spot is. And there's a huge uncertainty. And pressure's more than just the platinum phase state. And remember, the transition zone, we can't measure to 10%. So that's like 2.5 GPA.
You
could
not wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's not plus or minus 50 GPA. I mean, it's this is at the bottom of the mantle, isn't it? I don't know about that. Yeah. No, but Abby is working on solving all these problems as we speak, so it's just a matter of time. Yeah, I mean, it's really too bad that we didn't get a chance to talk more about experiments, because there are all kinds of interesting things, like the pressure calibration. So you calibrate the pressure against the platinum equation of state. Well, how did you calibrate the pressure for the platinum equation of state? And, well, the way you calibrate it is with another technique called shockwave compression or dynamic compression, where you can actually measure the pressure absolutely. But there are uncertainties there too, because you can't measure the temperature in the shockwave experiment. And so you have to correct for temperature somehow. And that's where some of the uncertainty in the platinum equation of state and in the pressure of these experiments comes from. And there are other sources too that Abby mentioned. Okay, so here is their phase diagram of the post-perovskite phase transformation, and again, you can move these around. Here, their estimates of the error bars. Maybe they're optimistic. I don't know. And they draw a phase bounder here, but obviously the Clapeyron slope is not constrained at all by their experiments, right? You could draw it like this. You could draw it like this. You could draw it whatever. But again, the important thing is that they did form a new phase, and it is stable at higher pressures. They constrain the density contrast between the two phases to be about 1%. The depth is near the bottom of the mantle. And again, completely unconstrained by the experiment is the Clapeyron slope, the effect of other elements, and the seismic wave velocity of the new phase. Yes?
I have a question about the naming convention, because earlier you were talking about how they get their name from whatever structure already exists that has that. Is there not anything that has a structure that just doesn't fit, or?
There is, but not a close enough analog. So for now, they're just calling it CMCM, which is the space group. Now, there are probably thousands of minerals that have the CMCM space group. And you could look through the Handbook of Mineralogy and find one that has a similar structure. anyway, so that's how they tend to get called now. PBNM for the perovskite phase and CMCM for the new phase. Right? Okay. So I guess we could call it the green phase or the blue phase if we wanted to. Okay, so what else can you do? Well, I'm sure that a lot of experimental groups are pursuing this and trying to constrain all these other things. As we speak, in the meantime, theorists are also jumping in. I can do a lot better than that. In fact, there are very good first principles calculations of what that slope is now. And I don't remember the number exactly. It was positive, and my impression was that it was a pretty normal value, like 4 megapascals per Kelvin. Yeah, she'll be here next week, so she can tell you all about it. And here's what the structure looks like. Okay, so here's the perovskite structure here, which I've labeled PBNM. And it consists of SiO6 octahedra here, so silicon surrounded by six oxygens, and the magnesium sitting in these cages formed by octahedra sitting at the vertices of more or less a cube. Now, as you go up in pressure, this angle between corner sharing octahedra gets smaller and smaller, and that corresponds directly to compression of the structure. All right? Because this is the biggest empty space in the structure, and by closing this angle, you close up that empty space. Now, as you keep going up in pressure, and you think about what happens when that angle closes, the octahedra are going to join, they're going to share an edge, and that will force this row of octahedra to separate from this row to conserve the number of oxygens. And so as you close that angle up, what you get is this. Chains of octahedra in this picture. Actually, they're sheets of octahedra because you have to imagine these coming in and out of the board infinitely. So you end up with this really intriguing structure. It's a strongly layered structure. It's got to be really anisotropic. If it deforms by dislocation glide, which it very well might, at the base of the mantle, this would be the preferred glide plane. You can say that without practically without doing the measurement or the calculation. And because of its layered nature, you expect it to be rather flexible, and so it might be very good at incorporating the other major elements that might be down there, calcium, aluminum, the heat-producing elements, and so on. It's fairly flexible, probably that way. The other thing you can say, sort of a priori, is that it'll probably have lower entropy than the perovskite phase. Why? Because it has edge-sharing octahedra, and this is something Abby talked about. Once those octahedra share an edge, they're much more restricted in the vibrations that they can undergo. And the average vibrational frequency tends to increase, and that tends to lower the entropy. So this is going to have a lower entropy than this guy, probably, one would expect a priori, which would correspond to a positive Clapeyron slope. And again, the calculations have been done, and they confirm that. I did want to mention that one of our own has been part of this story. Stephen Stackhouse has been doing first principles calculations of the CMCM phase, and he's been able to calculate the elastic constants of it, and to quantify just how anisotropic this structure is. And so what's plotted here is the P wave velocity of this new phase as a function of propagation direction, and as the P waves propagate normal to the planes, okay, this is the layering direction, they get really, really slow. And then in the other directions, they're much faster. And so the azimuthal anisotropy is enormous. The maximum shear wave splitting is enormous compared to what seismologists see at the base of the mantle. So this is a potential explanation then for the anisotropy that Guy showed yesterday at the base of the mantle, a preferentially aligned aggregate of these minerals. Now, the alignment, you wouldn't expect the alignment to be perfect, and any imperfection in the alignment would tend to lower these two values, possibly into the range that seismologists see. So, very intriguing properties of this phase. I expect you'll see a lot of stuff coming out on this phase in the next few months. Okay, so new phases, new physics. High spin, low spin transition. This idea has been around for forever, but it's never been observed experimentally until, I guess, last year was the first observation on magnesium-wustite. Just this month, while we've been here, this study on perovskite came out, and they found a high spin, low spin transition in perovskite, which is really cool. Okay, so here are the measurements, and this is another way that mineral physics has advanced. It hasn't all been machinery. It's been figuring out how to use novel probes of the sample. We're really limited in many ways in high-pressure studies, and so it pays to spend the time to figure out new kinds of probes. And this is one such probe where it's not simple. Basically, what you do is you force a low-lying 1s electron out of the iron atom, a 3p electron falls down, and the energy released by that 3p electron as it falls down turns out to depend on the magnetic moment of the iron atom that the 3p electron is sitting in. And so you get, and there are different selection rules depending on what the magnetic moment of the iron atom is. Anyway, what it all boils down to is that if iron is in the high spin state, you get this little shoulder here, and if it's in the low spin state, you don't. And what they find is that as you go up in pressure, you go from spectra that have shoulders, this is at 20 GPa, to the shoulder sort of decaying in magnitude very smoothly, to no shoulder at all at the highest pressure that they looked at, 145 GPa. Okay. High spin, low spin transition, this is what it looks like, and this will also lead into one of the possible implications of this observation. It's actually not one that I like, but it's one that the authors emphasize. Remember that when we looked at the quantum numbers and what happened to them as we went from a single electron atom to a multi-electron atom to an atom in a crystal field, in the crystal field you lift the degeneracy, the M degeneracy of, say, the 3D orbitals. All right? If the iron atom is in an octahedral site like this, sitting in the middle of an octahedron, the distribution of these 3D states actually looks more like this. You get a group of three down here, which are pretty close together, and then a big gap, and then another group of two, which are much farther up here. Geometrically, the difference is that these two guys correspond to d orbitals pointing along the bonds, and these three guys correspond to d orbitals pointing in between the bonds. Okay. Now, iron 2 plus has 6d electrons, and they have to decide how they're going to fit into these five states. Now, the really odd thing is that the iron electrons don't occupy the lowest lying states as much as they possibly could. The strange thing that they decide to do is to occupy different d orbitals as much as possible, and then the one that's left over is forced to doubly occupy the lowest lying state. Now, why would they decide to do that? Well, it turns out that the d orbitals are so localized, a pair of electrons inside a single d orbital repel each other so much, it's so energetically unfavorable, that the electrons do everything they can to avoid each other and go into different orbitals. All right. As you go up in pressure, though, this picture changes. And the way it changes is that the splitting between this upper group and this lower group gets much, much larger. So it becomes much more costly. As much as the electrons would like to occupy different d orbitals, it becomes much more costly to do so. And so eventually, it becomes more favorable for the electrons to pair up in the three lowest lying d states. Now, the implications of this are twofold. This state ends up taking up less space. If you want to think of the ionic radius of the iron, it shrinks as you go from this high spin state to this low spin state. And that would affect the density of your crystal. The density of the crystal would increase as the iron goes through this high spin, low spin transition. The other implication is this. You may know from experience, and it turns out to be true, that materials that have a lot of iron in them tend to absorb light. And the mechanism of, and they absorb a lot of infrared light too. It's easy to heat these things. And they tend to absorb infrared light. And that absorption would correspond to an infrared photon coming in, exciting this electron across the gap up to here. That's the absorption mechanism. Now here, the energy difference is much larger. And that corresponds to a higher energy photon. You need a much higher energy photon to excite, say, this electron all the way up to here, across that enormous gap. So you can only do this with visible light, it turns out. Yes?
You said the difference between high and low resistance has to do with increasing pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have to do with temperature as well? Or I guess that intuitively it seems weird that it would get bigger.
Yeah, mostly. Right. Mostly, it has to do with the volume actually, and over the mantle range, that's mostly pressure. Temperature is sort of a second order effect. Why is this? Well, we showed when we looked at the band structure that the width of the band goes like the strength of the interaction. The more strongly the orbitals are interacting with each other, the wider the band would be, the wider the separation between the bonding and antibonding orbitals, whatever. The way to make orbitals interact more strongly is to squish them together. And so as you go up in pressure, bands almost always broaden. And that's exactly what's going on here. As you go up in pressure, the orbitals are interacting more strongly and they split more. Okay? Yes?
Are they able to predict this without
anyone? Yes, and Ron Cohen has done some work on this in FEO. I don't think he looked at perovskite.
So this is like a different shape correlation?
You probably need to get this accurately. This turns out to be difficult for density functional theory, and you probably need to go beyond the local density approximation that I talked about. Yeah. Tell the A plus U or something like that. Yeah, and one reason for that is that it's such a local effect, it's such an atomic effect, and that's actually why why this experimental technique works, because it is sort of a probe of atomic scale structure.
How much less space that was going to take up?
Off the top of my head, no. I mean, there are estimates out there in the literature, I just don't remember them. And these guys make an estimate. And I don't know, 10% change in radius, something like that, 10, 20%. Yeah, I mean, you expect a significant increase in density. And one of the things that's puzzled me is that in the two high spin, low spin transition papers that have come out, they've chosen not to talk about the implications of the density contrast at all, which has been puzzling to me. It would also affect the elasticity, the seismic wave velocities. And I think that's one of the more interesting implications of this. Well, nothing happens until you get to 70 GPA or so. It's pretty much all high spin until you get to 70 GPA. And yes, there have been a few iron-bearing perovskite experiments that went beyond that. But the amount of iron, of course, is not very large. And so you'd have to look in detail at the experimental resolution and uncertainties and so on. Okay. So, anyway, they end up concluding that there are these, that it goes in sort of two steps, to an intermediate state and then to which is sort of half high spin, half low spin, and then finally to the completely low spin state. And there are some questions associated with this. Why two steps? At the highest pressures, they should be in the CMCM stability field. They didn't do X-ray diffraction at the same time. Not to blame them, I mean, the spectra that they took are novel enough that they didn't have to, but it'll be nice to sort of redo this experiment with X-ray diffraction also. Okay, so here's the connection to heat transport. So how can you transport heat? You can transport it with mass, that's convection. You can transport it with phonons, that's conduction. Or you can transport it with photons, and that's radiation. Now, what they found, actually, and this is kind of interesting, they heat their samples with a laser, and this works very well at low pressures because the frequency of the laser couples really well with the iron, and it's a very effective heater. But as they go into the low spin state, though, they can't heat their sample anymore. That was their observation. They weren't able to heat their sample. And the reason for that was that their sample had become transparent to the frequency of their laser. Now, if you look at, one question you might ask is, where is the light coming from down at the core mantle boundary? Well, it's coming from black body radiation. I mean, that's still going on. Photons are being produced. And the only question is, how far do they travel? All right, and if they can travel very far, then you can transport heat with them. And if the sample is transparent, at the right frequencies, at the right wavelengths, then this can be an efficient mechanism. And this high spin to low spin transition will tend to make the sample more transparent to the relevant wavelengths. And that's what this figure is meant to illustrate. as I mentioned, I have some issues with this. I mean, they make a big deal about the lowermost mantle having heat transport by photons. But iron isn't the only transition metal in the mantle, and I would wonder whether if you put all the other transition metals in there, even if they're trace amounts, whether they would be sufficient to lower the radiative conductivity to a point where, again, it became insignificant. Okay, so here's this radiative heat transport. It's come up many times during this meeting. Here it's sort of being resurrected from the dead. Again, it's just going to require more experiments to understand whether this is really important or not. Okay, new chemistry. So here's the observation. You take MgSO3 with some amount of iron in it, and that iron starts out all 2+, right? And you squeeze it, and you make perovskite, and what you find are these nice grains of perovskite here, and then you also find these little blebs of pure iron. You can show that these are pure metallic iron. There wasn't any pure metallic iron in the starting material, right? The other thing you see is that in the perovskite, you've got a lot of Fe3+ all of a sudden, which wasn't there before. So you've gone from all Fe2+ to some Fe3+ in the perovskite and some Fe0, presumably, in the metal. And how did that happen? This is the evidence. This is a Mossbauer spectra. They have other probes of valence state now that work better on very small samples. I guess the only thing one of the things that strikes me about this plot is that it's not a simple spectrum. And you see this is the Fe2+, their modeled Fe2+ component here, and this is the modeled Fe3+ component here. Okay? This technique has been around for a long time and been applied to sort of crustal minerals for a long time. And so how do you do it? Well, here's their preferred mechanism. Let's take out the FeO just as a component, okay? Let's not combine it with the silicate. Let's just take it out as a component, and as a component, it would be Fe2+O, right? FeO. And what you can do is you can break down that Fe2+ into some combination of Fe3+ and Fe0, right? Without violating charge balance or mass balance. And that's actually their preferred explanation, is that the Fe2+ that you start with has broken down. Some of it went to Fe3+, some of it went to Fe0. One of the downsides of this and is what happens when you now go back and consider what's happening in the real phase, which is MgFeSO3. And you have to think about exactly how the Fe3+ is accommodated in the perovskite structure, where the oxygens go, and so on. And their preferred mechanism actually requires or involves the creation of oxygen vacancies in the perovskite lattice. And this to me seems incredibly bizarre, that there would be vacancies in the lower mantle, because the lower mantle is at such high pressure, it would tend to disfavor very strongly any empty space in the crystal structure, basically. I mean, that's sort of my intuition about it. Of course, intuition has failed us many times in the past. Struggling to recover my intuition. I mean, there are other ways to get around this, and there are other ways to make Fe3+. And the sort of standard or common way to do it is just to react with oxygen. You can make Fe3+ that way too. You leave iron out in the rain for a long time, and it'll rust. That's oxidation, and that's all I've done here is I've oxidized FeO to Fe2O3. And so the issue here, I'm making a statement about the quality of the experiments. Were the experiments closed? Are they constant composition? Is it possible that some oxygen could have gotten in from the environment? Is it possible that some pore space in the initial sample material contained enough oxygen to cause this oxidation reaction to occur? Again, what you have to do is you have to combine it again with the full crystal structure and ask, can you also produce the iron metal this way? Or do you have to come up with some other mechanism for producing those little blebs of iron metal? Here's another possibility, and this is a little more wacky, but okay, you start it with FeO. We know that FeO metallizes at 70 GPa. It does this, right? And so this gets into very fundamental questions about what valence means at high pressure. You start it with FeO, it's all Fe2+, plus, all right, and then you metallize it. What is it now? Is it Fe2+, plus? Is it Fe0? What is it? Well, maybe it's just Fe3+, plus, and you've got an extra electron floating around the lattice somehow, and that's what's giving you the conductivity. And this is a very cartoonish way of looking at it, but maybe it's consistent with the Mossbauer spectra. I'm not sure, and I don't know enough about Mossbauer spectroscopy to know whether this spectrum could completely rule out this possibility. Again, we're not violating charge balance because the electron is still there in the crystal, sort of swimming around as a conduction electron.
Is this
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the questions. I mean, it's at fairly high pressures and temperatures, and you could ask about the duration of the run and so on.
It's a multi-anvil.
Yeah, multi-anvil, yeah. So it's... I mean, the diamond anvil cell we usually think of as a closed system. But the multi-anvil experiment, we're less sure. And in fact, the experimentalists take great pains to control the basically the chemical potential of oxygen with some buffer material that they put in the capsule or either within the sample. It comes back to, actually, let me back up. It comes back to something very fundamental that we talk about in thermodynamics. You have to constrain one from each of the three conjugate pairs of variables. You can constrain either pressure or volume, entropy or temperature, composition or chemical potential. In these experiments, they control the pressure, the temperature, and actually not the composition, which is the simplest thing to think about. They actually control the chemical potential, or they hope they do, at least when it comes to oxygen, which is a bit different than constraining the total amount of oxygen in the sample. So, you can use your imagination as well as anybody else can as far as the geophysical implications of little blobs of iron, pure iron, with that huge density contrast floating around in the lower mantle. All right? Maybe this is happening. Interesting, if true. Okay, water came up a couple of times, and this gets to a boundary layer that's very close to us, that's very sort of near and dear to us. And you can think of this boundary as sort of a reaction zone. I mean, you get soils have a lot of water in them, and some of that water penetrates even deeper into the rock and so on. And one of the questions then is, how deeply does this chemical reaction zone between water and silicate penetrate? Of course, subduction zones is one area where it can penetrate to rather substantial depths. We think it goes to at least 100 kilometers down and maybe even deeper. And so you can ask some questions. You know, how much water is in there? How many of these is in here? Or another way to ask it, is the Earth's hydrosphere concentrated at the surface, which you might naively think, or is it actually concentrated in the interior? And so far we don't have an answer to that question. It's open, I think. As a mineral physicist, you might ask a simpler question, and this is what I was talking about yesterday. What's the capacity of mantle materials to hold water? In other words, the solubility of water in mantle materials. How is it incorporated? And in the sort of shallow Earth, we think of hydrospaces, the shallow mantle, and then in the deep mantle, we think of what are called nominally anhydrous phases. These are phases that don't fundamentally alter their crystal structure as you add water to them. They incorporate that water within the crystal lattice without altering it. Yes? Yeah, that's a great question. And this came up at the Gordon conference, actually. And initially, some people would say, oh, of course we can, to within 10%, 20%. And then somebody would ask, why? How can you say that? And then they would say, well, okay, at least within a factor of two. And somebody else would have, why? So we ended up with no constraints at all. I don't know, maybe we needed some more sedimentologists in the room or something. But no, I think that's a very good question. Okay, so we think of these two classes of hydrous phases existing in the mantle. Hydrous phases, which have lots of water, and the water and the crystal structure exists because the water is in there. And so this is an example of a hydrous phase that we think is important in the subducting slab. As the water is being brought to greater depths, we think this is one of the ones that might exist in the subducting slab anyway. This is called the 10 angstrom phase, and it's interesting because it's a lot like a clay, but it's also different. Okay, and I'll explain the differences. So here's a layer of silicon tetrahedra, a layer of magnesium octahedra, and another layer of silicon tetrahedra, forming a TOT layer. All right, we have these little hydroxyl groups sticking up out of the layer in the middle of these rings of six-member tetrahedra. And we have another identical TOT layer up there. And in the interlayer, we have these H2O molecules. These little guys are H2O molecules, all right? And so we have a lot of H2O molecules. There's a ton of water in this structure. And the interesting thing is that this is not at all like montmorillonite, which you might have heard about. In montmorillonite, the water is really floating around very loosely in this interlayer. Instead, in the 10 angstrom phase, the water molecules are hydrogen bonded to these hydroxyls. So each water molecule is sort of sticking its nose into the middle of one of these six-membered rings and bonding itself to this inner hydroxyl. So it's actually very tightly bound. One of the questions is just how much water you can put in this phase. I put the maximum amount in this picture. Maybe it's only every other ring that's occupied with a water molecule. It could be that this phase can accommodate variable amounts of water, which would be interesting. This spacing from here to here is 10 angstroms. Yeah. Yeah. So for a typical clay, that spacing would be closer to 9 angstroms, and so that's why people focused on the sort of 10 angstroms as being unusual, not clay-like. Okay, here's a nominally anhydrous phase, or a possible nominally anhydrous phase in the mantle. This is stishovite. And you have to think about how you get the water into these nominally anhydrous phases. You have to charge balance it somehow. If you think about the hydrogen, it's H+. You have to charge balance that somehow with something that has an effective negative charge. So one thing you could do is you could substitute, so here's the stishovite structure, SiO6 octahedra. You could substitute one of these silicons for an aluminum, that is a lower charge, and then balance the charge back with a hydrogen. All right, so that's a charge balance substitution. And you can ask what the energetics of that substitution are. And you can ask then what the solubility of water in stishovite is in this nominally anhydrous mode of incorporation. And it turns out, and this is not the only mineral that you can do this with, it turns out you can put a lot of water in stishovite, several percent, and this is something that we might expect to be typical of high pressure phases where the sort of P delta V term in the Gibbs free energy might tend to drive water into these crystal structures. And in fact, Wendy's calculations show that the solubility does increase systematically with pressure. There's a lot more that needs to be done on these. We're just sort of in the infancy, especially when it comes to lower mantle phases. It's not marked. This is, I think, 17 GPa and this is 30 GPa. And the experiments are over a range of pressures from like 10 to 20 GPa, I believe. Okay. The other thing that came out of this study was that at least as you go to the completely substituted N member here, and possibly also over here, What you get is a very different kind of hydrogen bond. We usually think of hydrogens as being associated with one oxygen, right? So you get the hydrogen strongly bonded to this oxygen and then very weakly bonded to this oxygen over here. And the sort of triple, oxygen-hydrogen triple, lie on a line, but the hydrogen is much closer to one end of the line than the other. At high pressure, what happens is that this sort of space closes up and the hydrogen gets closer and closer to the non-bonded oxygen, and eventually you end up in the symmetrically bonded state. Now, this symmetric hydrogen bond is incredibly strong. We found that it's the strongest bond in the entire structure, even stronger than the SiO bond, at least in terms of its ability to change length with pressure. And so this transition from the sort of low pressure, sort of conventional wisdom of very asymmetric hydrogen bonding to high pressure symmetric hydrogen bonding could have a lot of important implications for elasticity and transport properties and so on. Okay, let me say briefly something that we really don't know anything about, and then I'll stop. And that is the, at least from the mineral physics perspective, and that is the asthenosphere. Okay. Abby talked about transport processes and activated processes, and attenuation or dispersion is an example of these. And so all these guys are going to depend on temperature and pressure in a way that looks something like this. There's going to be some activation energy, which corresponds to the energy required to for defect formation or for defect migration, or actually some combination of those two things. And that activation energy might depend on pressure. And you can describe that as the sort of pressure times activation volume term. And the temperature appears in here. And what that reflects is the fact that as you increase the temperature, it becomes easier and easier for the lattice to jump over activation barriers into this state where the defect is moved or migrated. Okay, here's one way that Wirtman came up with to sort of simplify or compact this relationship. He said, okay, so the activation energy is going to increase with pressure, but all this stuff, maybe I can scale it with the melting temperature of the material. If you think of solids as sort of perfect and liquids as very defective, well, maybe the melting temperature has something to do with the energy required to produce or move a defect. And so what he said is he came up with this more compact relation that just depends on the melting temperature of the material divided by temperature. So it's still the same basic form. Basically, what we've done is to replace del T plus P delta V on R with this melting temperature here, and then some scaling factor, which could vary, perhaps, from one material to another. And this ratio temperature to melting temperature is called the homologous temperature. And it's a very useful sort of rule of thumb to think about how activated processes depend on temperature and pressure. Okay, so let's see how these simple things do compared to seismological models of attenuation in the mantle. So here's attenuation, 1,000 over Q. Versus depth in the mantle. And the thing that really strikes me about all these seismological models are two things. The attenuation goes way, way up at 60 kilometers or so, and then sort of flattens out, and then it goes way, way down again. Now, the way, way up, the going up, the increasing, is easy to understand. You've got a thermal boundary layer at the top. Temperature on melting temperature is increasing dramatically by like a factor of 3, because the temperature is going from 300 Kelvin to whatever, 1,000, 1,500 Kelvin, so maybe even a factor of 5, okay? So temperature is increasing really rapidly in here, and that's what makes the attenuation go up. That's easy. The hard part is explaining this. Why is it going down just as sharply as it went up? That's, from the mineralogical perspective, that is bizarre. And, of course, what it reflects is not a problem with the seismological models, presumably, but just our ignorance of what's going on here. So here's some examples of what the Wirtman law gives you. So a rapid rise, and you could play around with just how rapid by choosing a different geotherm. So this disagreement doesn't worry me. It's this part that worries me. This is going down incredibly gradually compared to what seismology sees. I understand, but could you really spread out this decrease over 600 kilometers? Yeah. Right. And here's another choice of what the pressure dependence might be. I think what this emphasizes is that we have currently no information on, as far as I know, of what the effect of pressure on Q is from the laboratory. As far as I know, there's not a single data point. Jackson's measurements came up, and those are really nice, and I think they're the best that have been done. But as far as I know, he applies just enough pressure to sort of squeeze out cracks and pores, and he hasn't really tried to go even to mantle pressures yet. But I'm sure he will in the future. And at that point, we will learn a lot, I'm sure. So this is a big mystery to me, and it points out one of the frontiers for us, and that is to try to explore some of these more difficult, non-equilibrium, time-dependent transport properties, which are so important for understanding rates of things that go on in the Earth. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks. Yeah. No, I'm okay now. Thanks to Jasper. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean the variations are, you know, factor 2, factor 3, and so on. Let's see. Here we go. So 10 to the minus 5 per Kelvin. So it's dLnV dt.
Okay, I didn't think it's 10 to the minus 5.
Yeah. So.
Well,
yeah, I mean you still have the factor 2 or 3 variations. And I mean in order to interpret tomography in the simplest possible way, what you would like is a sort of scaling that didn't depend on depth. You could just apply the same thing to the whole mantle, right? Well, we can't do that. I mean, maybe you could think about taking some average over a Fresnel zone, say. I mean, here's a Fresnel zone and take an average over that. I don't know if that would be the right thing to do, but that's where communication between mineral physicists and seismologists would be important. Right. It's 1600 K, 80 bat. No thermal boundary layer. Well, that would affect the upper, like, 3 GPA here or so. So it could affect this first peak a bit, but none of this would change. Off the top of my head, I can't say. Yeah?
Coming back to this discrepancy that you see.
Yeah. Okay, so that is a very good question. So the conventional wisdom, and this is Garrity and Jordan, and then I guess Corrado picked up on it, is that, and I'm sure petrologists have thought about this for a long time before that, is that you start melting under a mid-ocean ridge. You start melting mantle at about 65 kilometers depth. You start generating basalt. You also start sucking all the water out of the mantle at about 65 kilometers depth. All right, and so from 65 kilometers depth to the surface, you've effectively dried out the mantle. All right, so this very sharp increase in attenuation here could represent the boundary between dry mantle above and wetter mantle below. All right, so again, that helps to explain the initial shallow increase in attenuation, but it doesn't necessarily help you with the deeper decrease in attenuation, because now, to invoke water, you'd have to come up with some mechanism by which water suddenly decreased or gradually decreased with increasing depth. And maybe you can come up with something with, subduction zones releasing a lot of water, and that release tends to be at rather shallow depths. But then you'd have to propagate that water somehow over large distances. Maybe there's something there.
In Dalian Himalayas, the very after this 10,000 temperature overshoot over the Mojave Desert, so we have a cold atmosphere and also then hot material beneath the moon.
Yes, my impression of those, I know what you're talking about. My impression of those is that the temperature excursions were very minor, maybe 100 degrees or something, which wouldn't help us here. Yeah. Okay, I didn't want to cut off questions, but I did want to take this opportunity to say something that I'm sure we all feel, and that is to express our appreciation to Barbara for organizing a fantastic meeting.